Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it like to live near the North Pole, and how is growing demand for oil, gas, and even diamonds changing the conditions in which humans, plants, and animals exist? Sarah Wheeler is a biographer and travel writer. 15 years before her journey north, she had spent 7 months exploring and delighting in the pristine majesty of Antarctica, with little interest in the polluted and disputed territory at the other pole. But as time went on, she found herself growing curious about the complex realities in the Arctic Circle, and ultimately took multiple trips there over 2 years, at times accompanied by her young sons. Sarah Wheeler's new book is called Magnetic North: Notes from the Arctic Circle. Sarah, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me.
So initially, your interest was only in the Antarctic, which you saw, and I hate this pun, as the polar opposite of the Arctic. Can you talk about your perceptions of one as compared with the other?
Yes, certainly. I spent 7 months in the Antarctic, as you've mentioned, Chris, and I was a young woman, a young writer, and the inspiration for the book and the motivation was it seemed to me that the Antarctic was a model, a symbol of hope and optimism and what the Earth could be, what we could get back to. And what I mean by that is it's completely unowned. It's this huge continent, 1.5 times the size of the U.S. Nobody owns it. There's never been any wars there. It doesn't support life. It's pristine. So it's all about idealism and hope, and those are the kind of things that a young writer should be interested in. The Arctic, on the other hand, is the opposite. It's not clearly defined. Where does it start or finish? Nobody really knows. It's just this ragged ring of land around a lot of ocean at the top of the world. It is owned, and everybody's arguing about who owns bits of it. There are lots of people there, and most of them are terribly unhappy. So if the Antarctic is a symbol of everything the Earth could be, the Arctic is a symbol of what the Earth is. And many years had gone by since I was in the South, and I'd sort of become middle-aged, as one does, and the Arctic really suits much more the elegiac melancholy of middle age. Mm. So it seemed really natural for me to go up there and have a look and to deal with those kind of issues which are about reality rather than idealism. So it is a sort of twin pole, really, to that other book. And I did find the Arctic was very much like the rest of the world in microcosm, in that desperate problems, intractable, all caused by the appalling behavior of humans, and yet one sees the lovability and the likability and the wonderfulness of humanity in all its fullness. And so it was a wonderful thing for me to engage with as a writer. And just to finish off on that question of the contrast between the two polar regions, both of which I know very well, I think that if one learns one thing as one gets older is that there's no black and white, there's only shades of grey, mm-hmm. and that there's no answers, there's only questions. And the Arctic really is the embodiment of that.
One thing I really liked about this book, and we have certainly talked to people who went to the poles specifically to sort of test their emotional and physical stamina, you weren't there to prove that you could survive physically.
No, and I don't do any of that sledge pulling business, of which I think there's quite enough of that out there already. I let other people get on with that. Mostly men, aren't they? And they publish books with frozen beards on the cover. I'm not disparaging what they do. I'm totally in awe of their physical skills, which I do not have. The thing I hate most is when people call me an explorer, because I'm absolutely not. I'm just a writer, and I'd go and observe, and I go by easy methods, you know. For example, if I'm going to visit a science camp on the top of the Greenland ice sheet, as I did, I'll go on a resupply plane. So nothing ever really goes anywhere just for me. I hop on and take a ride in order to observe and to tell. And I think it's my mission to sort of see what's there and come back and report the truth in a way. I think that's what I feel. And I find a lot of hope in the communities, despite the intractable problems. Sometimes the Magnetic North gets cast as a rather negative portrait in that there are so many problems. But I'd want to point out that I did find a lot of hope, and I think there's a lot of the positive stuff I brought away from the Arctic, and I hope that comes in the book. But certainly, I am not a frozen beard. And would I don't see either polar region as a testing ground to see how dead I can get.
The way that you organized your journey was inspired by a bracelet that a host had given you in Lapland.
Yeah, I was trying to come up with, Chris, some inner logic and coherence, which, of course, every journey needs. And my first trip was to Lapland with some reindeer herders, and they gave me this bracelet, and I was fiddling around with it, and suddenly it hit me that that's what I would do, a sequence of journeys around the circumpolar north. I would go anti-clockwise and end up pretty much where I started. And that's what happened, and I hope that does give some coherence to it. So it's this bracelet-shaped journey on which I can hang lots of different anecdotes and history and things that happened to me and things that interest me and observations in general and paint a portrait of the circumpolar Arctic. I tried to stay north of the Arctic Circle.
You went to Chukotka in one of your trips, which is known to Americans as that part of Russia that Sarah Palin can see from Alaska. Despite the geographic closeness, I was amazed there is no way to travel directly back and forth, or at least nothing exists.
It's absolutely extraordinary. You're right. I flew from Moscow to Chukotka, the Russian Far East, 9 time zones from Moscow to the Russian Far East. And as you say, one is perilously close to Sarah Palin's house at that point. But you can't go over the Bering Strait. And indeed, I met people in Chukotka, a few of the businessmen and MPs there, who had traveled to the United States, even to the west coast of the United States, but had to go all the way around the other way. There used to be some sort of flights between Providenia in Chukotka and Nome in Alaska. But those have been suspended, I think, mainly because of the appalling economic circumstances along the coast of the Russian Far East, and there's just not enough money to sustain a flight service. So there are no links at all. And Chukotka is the most extraordinary region, a quarter of a million square miles, no roads, and nothing grows. Very few people live there. And when you consider how close it is to the continental United States, it makes you realize that perhaps the world isn't quite so homogenized as we think it is.
You talk about the poverty there. In the villages in that region, unemployment is often as high as 70%.
Well, of course, what one finds around the circumpolar north is that the indigenous peoples, who of course were there absolutely long before any of us showed up, have been marginalized and economically disenfranchised because they tended to be nomadic. Most polar peoples were nomadic reindeer hunters. Some of them were marine mammal hunters, but if you're a marine mammal hunter, you have to migrate with the whales or with the seals. You have to move from place to place. Hunters, anyway. So even if they weren't nomadic, were semi-nomadic, or had one base but spent a lot of the time out hunting. And there's really no place for the nomad in contemporary society, in any settled culture. The trouble is the nationhood is inimical to nomadic life. You've got to have a social security number, haven't you, and this and that, and you've got to sort of speak the same language as the central government, and it's all about conforming. And so all the polar peoples really were dragged into the cash economy in various ways. What I noticed very much on my journey is that each country did it in a different way. In the United States in the 70s when the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was built, there was that enormously complicated financial arrangement with the Settlement Act, whereby cash was handed over to the First Nations peoples there in return for their land on which the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was built. So that was a sort of cash deal which had ramifications of its own. Canada, which was probably the country that's tried the hardest to do the right thing by its polar peoples, was sort of desperate stories of unintended consequences. Denmark and Greenland, all the Scandinavian governments in Lapland and Russia, all in a different way, tried to bring their various polar peoples into the fold. And there's far more of them than you think in terms of separate ethnic groups, by the way. There's 17 different polar peoples in Russia alone. But if you take away people's livelihood and draw them into the cash economy, you've really got to provide something for them to do in the cash economy.
Yeah.
It's never going to really work being a reindeer herder and selling enough reindeer to live like you and I do. And that hasn't really happened. And I think that's perhaps one positive aspect of the hydrocarbons, which are set to become an economic driver across the polar regions, is perhaps they will bring some kind of employment for Indigenous peoples. I mean, Toyota aren't going to come and build a plant any time now up in the Arctic Circle. So there's an awful lot of people up there who've been disenfranchised, been brought into the cash economy. But what are they supposed to do?
So when you were in Chukotka, it happened, and I guess you didn't plan it this way, that President Medvedev, became the first person in his position to ever visit that part of the country.
It was absolutely bizarre. And one slightly feels one's in a parallel universe in the Arctic anyway, especially in the Russian Arctic, sort of divorced from all reality. And one thing we haven't mentioned about Chukotka is that it's closed to foreigners.
Right.
So this is a quarter of a million square miles, 2 inches from Alaska, and it's completely closed to foreigners. The story of how I got in there is extremely long and laborious. We won't go into it, but I did. And no head of state had ever been there. Why on earth would they? No czar went within hundreds of miles of Chukotka. And certainly no prime minister or president has ever gone there. So no remote interest. So it was absolutely bizarre, and as you say, completely unplanned. I suddenly found myself in a group of only about 100 people, all holding our mobile phones aloft, taking photographs of President Medvedev, who'd showed up now and was very politely waving to us all and glad-handing the crowd and so on. Now, this is very symptomatic of how the Arctic has moved center stage. Why had he gone there? He had gone there so that there would be television footage around the country and around the world of the Russian premier, the Russian president in the Arctic, showing how desperately Russian it is. Mm. And, of course, that matters a lot, because if the Arctic's Russian, all that bit of it, it means the oil and hard rock minerals underneath it is also Russian. So there he was, patting a reindeer, waving to a whole lot of Chukchi and me outside the only supermarket. The supermarket is such a highlight of these quarter of a million square miles that Medvedev had to be toured around it. Rather an odd experience. Because nothing grows, everything is imported.
Yeah.
Everything is imported, sort of flown thousands of miles. But it really brought it home to me how geopolitics has invaded the Arctic now, and we're going to be seeing a lot more of it. And immediately after Medvedev's visit, of course, Stephen Harper, the Canadian Prime Minister, went hairing up his bit of Canada to prove how wildly Canadian it was, and everybody's got expeditions out showing that their continental shelf extends a long way into the Arctic Ocean because you own the mineral rights as far as your continental shelf extends, and people squabbling over it. Now, this, of course, leads us into climate issues and the warming climate, because as the ice melts on the Arctic Ocean, it does make it an awful lot easier to drill. So in a way, the Arctic Ocean is yielding its secrets and making drilling more possible. And as you know, licenses are being granted left and right for Arctic sites to be assayed for drilling all around the circumpolar north. Greenland, for example, has just granted a whole load more leases for oil companies to drill off its west coast. And, of course, that for the Greenlanders is a crucial part. It's very complicated and interconnected story. That for the oil for the Greenlanders is a crucial part of their story, their journey towards self-determination. They are effectively a colony of Denmark, and they've been on a journey towards self-determination for some time. They achieved home rule some years ago, and every decade they sort of get a step further. But really, they've gone as far as they can go now until they find a way of gaining some economic independence. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that in a minute.
Sounds good. Sarah Wheeler is my guest. She's a biographer and travel writer whose new book is called Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is biographer and travel writer Sarah Wheeler. Her new book is called Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. You brought up Greenland before the break, Sarah, and I was curious, are mineral rights the biggest impediment to Greenland's full independence from Denmark?
No, the impediment to Greenland's full independence from Denmark really is its subsidy. Every Greenlander has a huge subsidy, works out every year from the Danish government, and it would be impossible for Greenland to survive as a nation without that. So the impediment to independence is an income stream that Greenland can generate. And as I said before, you aren't going to get any car manufacturers going up to build things in Greenland. How can they generate enough national income to liberate themselves from the Danish subsidy? There's only one way, and it's through their hydrocarbon industry and through granting licenses to multinationals who want to come and drill offshore. So you see, it is a very complex business, and it's not straightforward enough for, you know, to say, well, for environmental reasons, we should not do any drilling at all. You know, we've got to keep this area pristine, because that's a little bit like saying, you know, it's okay for us to have all of this, but you can't have any of the economic independence and affluence because it's more important to keep the environment safe. It's a little bit like what happened to people who lived off Wales, indigenous hunters who lived off Wales, when people in the developed world started going on about saving the whale and wearing badges and all the rest of it, without any real understanding of the implications of that and how all these things are very interconnected and multi-calibrated, and we can't go around simply imposing our own value systems on the polar peoples. Now, of course, I think, I have all people who've seen how wonderfully pristine the polar regions are. I think it's crucial that drilling is extremely carefully monitored, that all environmental protocols are followed, that any oil company that breaks the protocols is extremely severely punished, and all the rest of it. That is essential. That almost goes without saying. But beyond that, I think, you know, I'm not really prepared to give up my car, and you're probably not prepared to give up yours. Mm-hmm. And we have to allow polar people the same measure of freedom of choice that we have. But certainly, this is a story that's yet to reach its conclusion.
One reason that environmental protection is so important, you know, a lot of times people who oppose the standards that have been set say it's not really necessary to protect these animals. But in fact, the human beings who live there eat those animals. And because they have such a high fat diet from hunting and fishing, in fact, some of those toxins are carried into their bodies in much greater amounts than they would be if they had a more varied diet.
Well, this is something ghastly called the Arctic paradox. And what the Arctic paradox means is that often people who live the furthest away from contaminants are the most contaminated. Let me give you an example, Chris. A long, long time ago in the 70s, there were some really horrible chemicals called PCBs mm-hmm. that you might remember, used in flame retardants and all the rest of it. And every developed country pretty much banned them. So they have not been used since about 1975, certainly in the United States or in Europe. They were really ghastly, horrible things. But they found their way into the marine food chain. And as you say, they are among the poisons that are not water-soluble, but they're lipid-soluble. That means they like fat. They like animals with lots of fat. And for obvious reasons, animals in the polar regions have more fat. So here we have all these PCBs sloshing around in the marine food chain, getting into the fat of fish and then the higher mammals and then polar bears. And by bioaccumulation and biomagnification, there gets more and more of them and more powerful. And believe it or not, scientists are finding now, and there's a lot of clinical data on this, really high levels of toxins in the brains of polar bear cubs being born now. And as for the communities of humans who still eat country food, as they call it, or at least that country food constitutes a portion of their diet, if not all of it, then some of them have tremendous health issues going on as well. There's a group of people in northeast Greenland who qualify as toxic waste.
Based on what they're consuming and what's in their bodies?
Based on their diet, and their diet has got lots of poisons that we pumped into the system 40 years ago.
And there are places where this is affecting the balance between men and women.
Yeah, that's in the polar peoples of Russia, particularly Eastern Russia. So there's, again, clinical data on this. Clinicians are finding a tremendous increase of, I think it's like 3-1 of females to males being born, which is not a great thing to happen in terms of the social balance. And that is being determined by various toxins that are affecting the hormonal balance of women in the polar regions and men.
I'm curious, Sarah, about how nationalistic indigenous peoples who live in places that are claimed by countries whose cultures are sort of different from their own native culture, how nationalistic they feel. Do people in Chukotka feel like Russians, or do they feel more aligned?
Like Chukotkan.
Yeah.
Like Chukotkan. Well, it's a good question, and I think the answer is it varies from region to region. For example, in Scandinavia and Eastern Russia, where you have the Lapps, now they're called Sami, the Sami peoples, they have a tremendous strong sense of Sami nationhood. So that's going across Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. And the Sami people have always moved across that arc, and they have a very strong sense of Sami identity. So I think those Sami would say, we are Sami. There is such a thing as a Sami passport. They do have unrestricted travel between those countries. There's even a Sami parliament. Now, it is pretty toothless in terms of its powers, but still, mm-hmm. It's there, and they have a tremendous sense of identity. It's much weaker in Russia simply because they've been so demoralized by how they've been treated, sort of bureaucratized out of existence in the Soviet era, and diminishing and cultural collision, cultural erosion, very difficult for them to keep hold of their roots. Drink made a big issue, a lot of migration south. So weaker. I think that in Greenland, because of the striving for nationalism, I think there's a strong sense of being a Greenlander. If you mm-hmm. always, of course, before a country does achieve full nationhood, and that's when people feel the most nationalistic. I think in Canada and the United States, there's been a greater degree of assimilation. So I would say certainly what I experienced in the communities of the North, Barrow and so on and so on, that people did feel American, and likewise in Canada. So I think there's been, on later years, positive and beneficial contact and a lot of integrating with the system, which has done those communities some good.
Is there any satisfying explanation for why alcoholism has been such a scourge among these populations?
Well, it's a huge issue. And as you know, Chris, we find the same problem in indigenous communities all around the world. The Aboriginals in Australia, you know, have tremendous alcohol problems. There's a lot of different factors one could bring to bear, but I think the most significant, and certainly one that I saw all over the place, was one that we slightly have covered a bit earlier, is that if you remove people's identity and give them and take away their whole reason for living and all their whole set of meanings that have given their lives some sort of structure, there's nothing for them to do. And you tend to find that then a sort of alcohol and drugs and so on flood in to fill the vacuum. And don't forget, the indigenous peoples, they were lived so closely to their land, and the land had tremendous sense of meaning for them. It was imbued with the spirit of their ancestors. It was a whole sort of system going on that all had meaning. And I think if you take away all of that, there is this big vacuum. And, people who've given up traditional ways in lower latitudes, they have some ability to get work of some kind and have some structure and meaning. So I think it's sort of deracination. It's cutting people out of what has been for millennia their lives. And don't forget, they've been at it for an awful long time, these peoples in those environments. It seems to allow the sort of empty spaces and meaninglessness that comes into play when you cut people off from their land. It seems to be very fertile ground for alcohol and drugs.
So do you think the next thing to happen will be a southward migration by a lot of people who want something better than what's available in the places where their ancestors have been raised?
Well, that's difficult to say. I mean, a certain amount of southward migration has happened already. In places like Canada, the creation of Nunavut and a creation of some sort of administrative structure there. And Nunavut, of course, is now a territory, a self-contained territory, part of Canada. It is providing some kind of administrative structure which people can live within. And certainly in the current climate, there's an awareness that a migration south isn't necessarily going to provide employment anyway. In the case of Russia, most people, a lot of the polar peoples, you know, just financially are not empowered to go south or don't have the education or otherwise it's made very difficult for them. We've seen a lot of southward migration. Whether there'll be an awful lot more, who knows?
I was really interested in the time that you spent at the, I hope I'm saying this right, the Tulik Field Station.
Oh, yeah, so it was wonderful. I had a wonderful time there.
Amazing place. And honestly, the thing that stuck with me the most is the issue of water, which is not what people might imagine.
Yes. What do you mean? How one has to husband water on the station?
Yeah, and essentially getting water in is not such a problem, but getting water out is exceptionally expensive.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I've had that experience in lots of polar camps. Same in the Antarctic. Tulik is a science station run by the University of Fairbanks, and scientists in both polar regions are tremendously aware that they're there in order to work on a pristine environment. So what they don't want to do is start chucking all their waste stuff around the place to immediately make the field unpristine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some areas of the Antarctic called the Dry Valleys where even the liquid human waste is carried out in barrels slung beneath helicopters so as not to contaminate the nitrate balance, because it's so important for nitrochemists and nitrobiologists to have that pristine environment. And the same in Tulik. They trucked out all the water. Now, that's a very expensive thing to do, and it means that you've got to really husband the grey water, as you call it, which is things like washing up liquid and so on. So there's a lot of very careful equations done to work out, is it ecologically more advantageous, it is, by the way, to use paper and wooden cutlery and so on that you can burn,
mm-hmm.
than it is to use stuff that you've got to wash and then truck the water out. So a lot of stuff is burned for that reason. And it's a bit, it is all very carefully policed. And things like showers are very carefully policed and monitored. I can't remember what the rules were now, but I think it was 1 3-minute shower every 3 days or something like that. But yes, these things are very carefully controlled, and a lot of the scientists are working on the permafrost, which of course is a key component, the permafrost in a warming climate, because one of the many, many factors of a warming climate is the permafrost we know to be softening. But if it starts to really melt out, then the amount of methane released in Siberia will be so enormous that could possibly have a more powerful effect even than the water melting off the glaciers. So just to wrap up your question, if you are working on permafrost and trying to unlock these crucial records, the last thing you want is your land being irrigated by a load of grey washing up water from the local science camp.
And at this point, it has been demonstrated that the Arctic Circle is warming at 3 to 5 times the rate that the rest of the planet is?
Yeah, that's right. That's why the Arctic has become the real sort of hot topic, excuse the pun, for climate change. And polar bears are its poster boys, aren't they? There's lots of reasons for that, one of which is, of course, the Greenland ice cap, which mm-hmm. contains the most enormous amount of ice. And we know it's melting fast, so it's discharging this huge amount of fresh water into the saline Arctic Ocean, and that has a massive effect both on temperature and also on the salinity of the water. And that means that the whole pumping system, which is pumping water around the planet, basically pumping cold water down from the north and warm water up from the tropics and then overturning at key pump sites around the Arctic Ocean, those pump sites are being weakened by, among other things, this great increase in fresh water, because, of course, salt water is much heavier than fresh water, so it doesn't overturn in the same way if the saline balance is disrupted. then that is going to have a huge effect on a changing climate.
And when polar seas and polar land are covered with that cap of snow and ice, they're also acting as a reflector in the same way that, you would sort of wear a white shirt on a very hot day.
Yeah, that's another huge issue, the albedo effect, which is basically the how much is white and how much is dark. And that's particularly the case at sea because the seawater is very dark. So you've got this massive lid of ice, which hitherto has been over pretty much the whole Arctic Ocean in winter and some of it in summer. But that's melting out, so you've suddenly got masses more open water, which is dark. And dark water absorbs the heat, which means warm planet, whereas the ice reflects the heat back, as you say, doesn't absorb, which means cold planet. So that has a huge impact on the rising temperatures that we've been seeing in the Arctic, which are duly passed on to lower latitudes.
What's a typical day like for scientists at a polar field station?
Well, one of the big advantages of working in the polar regions as a scientist in the summer is you've got 24-hour light. So it costs such a lot of money to get up there and to get your field time that people tend to start really, really early. So, for example, when I was with the ice corers on the top of the Greenland ice sheet, we all lived in these pyramid tents, one each, called Arctic ovens, rather misleadingly named, if you ask me. So we would crawl out each morning looking like sort of creatures at some key stage of evolution. And then you'd have the rigmarole of if you were on your own in a small camp, going to chip off ice on a glacier and melting it for fuel, or if you're on a big camp, like at Summit Station, going into the camp house, having breakfast, getting warmed up, getting your flasks, then you jump on your snowmobile and tow your gear out to your drilling site, which is set up for the whole station, for the whole season. And then you're looking at a really long day, drilling ice cores, incredibly hard work logistically. There's two drillers manoeuvring this enormous drill into a hole. You've got to keep your engine going. You've got to keep your fuel moving. You've got to get your ice core out uncontaminated. Then it has to be chopped up.
Let me have you stop there, and we'll take a quick break. Sarah Wheeler is my guest. She's a biographer and travel writer. Her new book is called Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Sarah Wheeler. Her new book is called Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Sarah, you were describing this incredibly long day of work at a polar field station for scientists. And you just got to the stage where they had pulled out their ice cores and maybe were breaking them up and processing them.
Yeah, what they have to do then is they chop the ice cores look a lot like telegraph poles, Chris, and they're about that width, and they'll then chop them into about a 3 feet long segment, so they've got to be very quickly, properly wrapped up, because you don't want to contaminate them. I mean, even a drop from your nose would contain more contaminants than one of those cores have in them, and when you consider that what we're getting from those deep cores is a close analysis of the composition of the air hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So you don't want to sneeze on one, wrapped up, and then taken down to an underground, to a cave underneath the ice where they're stored. And it's absolutely astonishing crunching around one of these caves. The scientists will say, see that? That's Civil War era ice. You see, that's Revolutionary War era ice. And all that has to be then, after you've done all of that, get shipped back to the home laboratory in Denver or wherever it is at. And that is not plain sailing either, because of course you've got to keep the cores below freezing, and they have to go back on what they call cold deck, where you keep the interior of the hold of the plane below freezing. I know that because I flew back with them. They stayed frozen and so did I. And so the corers, the ice corers, just going back to the typical day of a scientist, they're having to keep themselves going throughout all of this, manhandling equipment, some of which you have to take your gloves off, you know, which is not very pleasant in the polar regions, battling to keep their own body temperature up and to make sure that none of this stuff gets contaminated and that the ice all gets stored appropriately where it should be and properly labelled. I remember one of the drillers, I said to her, God, you know, how do you manage these enormous long days at these temperatures? And she said, you know what, I see this ice as a beautiful route to knowledge.
Hmm. It's worth pointing out here, not on this segment of the journey, but in others, you had your very young children with you at ages that a lot of, at least American parents, would hesitate to bring their kids to Paris.
People think that it was all for very high and mighty reasons because I wanted them to experience the Arctic, but mostly it was because I needed a babysitter. I only took them on two trips, actually, each on one. The first one was my second son. I just had him, so I couldn't go anywhere without him. I was nursing, mm-hmm. and I was going to visit these Swedish Laps, Arctic Laps, doing their reindeer herding twice a year. They bring the reindeer down from the mountains and take them back up again. And you know, all the families are there, including all the lap mothers, the lap babies. So I thought, well, I'll just do what they do, and I did, and wrapped him in lots of reindeer pelts. And, you know, it was fine. He was 3 months old. He didn't care about anything except being with me. Mm-hmm. It was fine. I did balk when they tried to get me to wean him on cubes of canary yellow reindeer fat. But it was fine. And, of course, the tremendous icebreaker, excuse the pun, for getting people to befriend me and so on. And then my eldest son, I took across the Arctic Ocean on a Russian icebreaker, really because I could, because I had a cabin with two bunks in it. Mm-hmm. So I sort of snuck him on. And icebreakers are heaven on earth for 10-year-old, 9-year-old boys, because they've got lots of moving parts and sharp bits and grinding up all the ice, and we saw lots of polar bears. And my son was the only child on board, and the Russian crew absolutely adopted him and took him down to the bowels of the ship, to the sauna. So any good Russian ship has a sauna in the bottom. And as a result, he is never going to be allowed ever to learn Russian at school because his Russian vocabulary is so wildly unsuitable.
He speaks like a sailor, essentially.
I'm afraid so.
Talk about the language issue, because you went to places where many different tongues were spoken, and in many cases you had translators, but their English was often not good enough. It was not akin to what you would find using a fixer in some other location.
It's difficult. It's difficult. But things are difficult in extreme environments. But that's what I do. I had to either use translators or I had to find people who spoke English, which, of course, in some places was very easy. In
sure.
some places, it was rather harder. And then if worst came to the worst, just kind of see what I could see without language. I think if you are going to try and see things at the sharp end or be at the front line, to use another analogy, you've got to just try and battle your way through and see what you can. And I've never really found that language is an insurmountable hurdle. One can get over everything, and I just, you know, wanted to be able to give the peoples a voice. That was the main reason. And by and large, I did. These days, outside of Russia, certainly, you're always going to find some of the community who've learned English because they have to for the interactions they have with the outside world.
You end the book with the story of this place in the Russian White Sea region called Solovki, which is home to, among other things, a remarkable monastery. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I started and finished the journey in Russia. Started it in Chukotka, as we said, which is so far away, and started it European Russia, which is very close to me in England. And the White Sea, which is really the start of the Northeast Passage. We hear so much about the Northwest Passage, but the Northeast Passage is its equivalent, Atlantic to Pacific, the other way around, 5,000 miles of sea across the top of Russia. And the White Sea, there's this little archipelago called Solovki, and a monastery there which I went to, which is one of the most sacred sites of Orthodoxy, always has been. All the Tsars visited, founded in the 13th century, tremendously holy place, these wonderful weathered silver onion domes, very sort of classic Russian landscape, and wintry, very salty winds of the White Sea, everything sort of kippered. So a very, very holy site of pilgrimage, and it was wonderful to hear the monks chanting. But it turns out that after the Russian Revolution, the monks were chucked out, and this place, Solovki, was turned into the first gulag, And the Gulag system, of course, spread, as Solzhenitsyn put, like a cancer then across the whole country. So appalling scenes in this polar gulag, of which are well recorded, in the same monastery chapels that the monks had worshipped since the 13th century. The horror beyond belief, horror that can't really be expressed, goes too deep for words. And now the monks are back again. And so it was a perfect place for me to end, because in a way everything was there. Everything I found in the Arctic, which was both beauty and horror, and the cruelty and ghastliness and horribleness of humanity, but also the hope and the dignity and the endurance. And that really summed up what the Arctic was for me.
Was it a surprise for you that the monks would sort of find their way back there and find their way back to the faith that they had had before they were unceremoniously removed and had their place, their sacred place, used for such horrible things?
Was it a surprise to me? Do you mean that anybody had bothered to revive it as a monastery?
Well, that it felt right to do so.
Oh, yes. I think there was a very strong feeling that it was a way of honoring the dead, mm-hmm. particularly as, of course, many people who died in the gulags in the first years were clergy. And there's many stories of priests being taken, not as priests and monks, but as prisoners to Solovki and being tortured and dying there. And the monks there now would say that their prayers now are partly out of respect and redemption for the suffering that went on there. And they want to honor the good people who gave themselves up into this jaw of evil, and to celebrate the continuity of the Holy Spirit and the there on that island, and that the Spirit did not die. Somebody there said to me, you know, they did such horrible things, but the Spirit did not die.
Another thing that you take on in the book is the sort of mythology of Robert Flaherty's film Nanook of the North. What we saw on screen was not exactly what took place.
No, I mean, first of all, let me say that's got to be the finest documentary ever made in my book. I think it's absolutely wonderful. And I think the fact that the story behind it is not quite the idyll that one might think doesn't detract from the truth conveyed in the documentary. I think what you're referring to is the story of Flaherty's relationship. He was the lover of the actress in the film. The hunter didn't die a natural death later on, as Flaherty put it about. He died of disease. The reality of the story and the sort of exploitation, as some people have said, was very different from what was put around. However, I think that film depicts a truth that's truer than the truth, like a lot of art does.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's a wonderful depiction. But the story of Flaherty and the children he left behind, for example, in the Arctic, like many of the stories behind great works of art, doesn't really stand up to the artistic integrity of the work itself, but I don't think that devalues the work.
Let's go to the phones now. On the phone we have Jim in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Oh, hi there. I'd like to just ask the author, having gone to the ends of the earth and experienced global warming, why do you think that there's such a resistance to this reality among so many people? And I'll hang up. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Well, Jim, that is a brilliant question, and I don't know. God alone knows. I don't quite know how the right or the climate change deniers, they seem to have got it into their mind that it's some sort of left-wing liberal conspiracy. It's very allied, and that it's a sort of conspiracy against the motoring lobby and so on and so on. I think maybe it's partly based on fear of change, fear of control being taken away from them, fear of liberty, fear that the state's going to start imposing. But it's a mystery to me how people can deny the reality of what's going on. I went to the Arctic with an open mind in terms of what was going on in global warming, and I came back really convinced of two things. One, something really big is happening very fast, and it's got a lot to do with anthropogenic interference, i.e. what mankind is doing, and we've got to do something about it. Two, there are no other certainties. We don't know anything else. Everything else is occluded in huge amounts of doubt and uncertainty, and we don't know which thing's going to happen first and all of that. And I think that sort of doubt has fueled the climate change deniers, because they are looking for certainties, and there are so few certainties. But I really feel it's the responsibility of those of us who have read the material, been up there, the scientists doing the work, to really try and keep educating and get it into people's heads that, you know, this ridiculous denying lobby is not going to get anybody anywhere, and we've got more important things to do. And that, you know, of course, part of the trouble is the oil industry are always going to have a huge amount of money, more than the other side, in order to fund studies as their own.
Sarah, in terms of your sort of understanding of human nature, how would you compare the impact of your trip to the Arctic with your earlier trip to the Antarctic?
Well, it's got a lot to do with age, really. I mean, I think when I was young and I went to the Antarctic, I was a little bit more idealistic, but I'm 50 now. I'm 50, turn 50 next week, and I think that I'm much more aware of, when you say about human nature, that it is deeply, deeply flawed. And I think in the Arctic, you see how deeply flawed it is because of the mistakes we've made, the way we've treated our indigenous peoples, the tremendous mess we're getting ourselves into, as the caller Jim referred to, is people actually going around saying that this is all a left-wing conspiracy and there's no global warming at all. So I think that the Arctic is extremely revealing about humanity and all its horrors and all its goodness. And I think it's a writer's duty to find hope. And I did find hope in what is the reality, which is not a pristine reality like the Antarctic, and like I used to think one could aspire towards in my youth.
Well, maybe that makes it easier to do something about it, if we understand that it never has been and never will be perfect, but it can be better.
Oh, I think that's right. I think that's what helps us to do anything, don't you? And I certainly feel even in one's daily life that one's not aspiring towards perfection, just battling on. Mind you, I'm English, and coping is pretty English. I remember there was a book published some years ago called Coping with Back Pain in America, in Britain, and they had to change the title to Conquering Back Pain in America because Americans could never be sold anything to do with coping. It was very American. It's about conquering, whereas we English people are content to just stagger along and do the best we can.
I guess the world needs both kinds.
Yeah, I guess so.
We just have about 30 seconds left. Can you give us a description of the Northern Lights?
Oh, the Northern Lights is like technicolor curtains rippling through the sky with straight skeins of opalescent beads in between them. So the curtains will be drawn one way very quickly, drawn the other way, and they're rippling and shining and sparkling and glinting. Then they completely disappear as if they've been turned off. And you think, oh, that's the end of that. And then very, very slowly they start to appear and the whole thing starts again.
That's lovely. The new book by biographer and travel writer Sarah Wheeler is called Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle. Sarah, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Well, thank you for talking to me, Chris. I enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1, KERA, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton, and online at kera.org. Also, 100.1 K261 CW Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV Sherman. Think is on the way. This is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1. It's 1 o'clock.
I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, how biology explains warfare and terrorism and offers a path to a safer world. My guest this hour will be obstetrician and research scientist Malcolm Potts, who says our drive to team up and do battle is rooted deep within our genetic heritage. We'll talk to him about the evolutionary costs and benefits of warfare, about how the stakes changed when humans invented projectile armaments, and why our most dangerous weapon may be testosterone. Our conversation starts after the news from NPR.